Let's pray together. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable to you, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Early in Jesus' ministry, we find ourselves at a wedding and the wine has run out. For the already drunk crowd, Jesus turns hundreds of gallons of water into the finest, most potent vintage these hosts have ever drunk. There's a hungry crowd. Jesus takes this little bit of loaves and fishes and breaks them into pieces, and the crowd is so full, and there is still more. 12 baskets more than anyone there could eat. There is a child. He returns home after wasting his father's estate on scandalous living, and he is welcomed back with this luxurious meal and this beautiful ring and a thick robe. And there's a woman named Mary. Jesus comes to eat at her house after he has raised her brother from the dead. And in this moment, she takes what she has, a year's worth of wages, and goes out and buys this bucket of perfume. It would be common in these days, after weary travels, after long distances on foot, for the host to wash the feet of people who come to their home. We'll actually do this next week on Maundy Thursday, as we gather here to remember Jesus washing the feet of his disciples. But imagine if instead I brought out a gallon of perfume and kneeled down to wash Chris's feet. This past week, I was at a store and I noticed there were these bottles of perfume. And I was thinking, I think I saw something like 6 ounces of perfume. It cost like $150. Chris, it would take me $12,800 for me to bathe your feet in that perfume, which sounds awful. But that's what happens in the story. And then from time to time, this would happen in the ancient world. There's one writer named Petronius who recalls that he's at this banquet one day, and the host, in order just to show his overwhelming hospitality, sends out an enslaved person with this silver basin of perfume to wash the feet of the guests. Another writer from this time, Plutarch, recalls a time when the host washed the feet of the guests in spiced wine. That also sounds terrible and sticky, but again, that is what happened, because this is the way to show off your impressive, massive hospitality, a totally over-the-top celebration of a guest. And so in the story from John, Mary takes this act of washing feet to the furthest extreme, wiping Jesus' feet bathed in expensive nard with her own hair instead of with a towel. The stench and decay of Lazarus's tomb is now replaced with this potent smell of perfume that we read fills the entire house. I have no doubt. And someone notices this. It's a disciple named Judas. It's hard not to notice this. The whole point is to notice it. And this is where we learn that because Judas is a thief, he actually wants this money to himself, stolen from the common purse. And so he is angry, and he announces to everyone the shame of Mary's act. Such an extravagant gift could have been sold and the proceeds given to the poor. It's interesting to see how Jesus handles this exchange. If I was in this situation, I would have lit Judas up for his hypocrisy. Oh my gosh, I would have called it out in front of everybody. I would have told everybody why Judas is so invested in this year's worth of perfume. Instead, Jesus says this: leave her alone. She bought it so that she could prepare me as I arrive towards my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. A banquet for a wayward brother, a wedding overflowing with wine, a party thrown for a lost coin, a celebration for the one sheep that's been brought back. Each of these stories in the Bible is a public act that identifies the importance of a moment that's happening. These events are so overwhelming that they require something from the participants. Those who witness them, they're overtaken by love. They're overtaken by joy. And they're so overwhelmed that they throw caution to the wind. Whatever budgets they had or pennies they pinched, none of that matters now. Another name for that is worship. People get caught up in the ecstasy of recognition. It's excessive and unreasonable and irrational and irresponsible. And I suppose the reason Jesus doesn't take on Judas the thief in the way that I would is that he can actually see to the heart of what's happening here. Judas looks at Jesus like another preacher, a dangerous one. Judas is about to betray Jesus because he doesn't know who Jesus is. He hasn't yet entered the world of worship, this world of abundance. And so we're invited to see as Mary sees. We're invited to this act of recognition of who Jesus is. The time with Jesus is short, death is near, and this moment consumes all other concerns, all other calculations, all other plans. I was 19 years old when I heard Tony Campolo tell this story I'm about to tell at College Chapel, and it I think about it all the time. Tony tells the story of going to this old cruddy diner one night. He's got jet lag and it's like 3:30 in the morning. And it's just about this time that this group of sex workers is getting off work and going to this diner where they're having this meal before they get on with whatever they have to do next. And Tony says, their talk was loud and crude. I felt completely out of place. He's like a preacher and was just about to make my getaway when I heard this woman say, tomorrow's my birthday and I'm going to be 39. And this other woman responds in a nasty tone, so what do you want from me? A birthday party? You want me to get a cake and sing happy birthday? Come on, this woman says, why do you have to be so mean? I was just telling you it was my birthday. I don't want anything from you. I mean, I've never had a birthday party in my whole life. Why should I have one now? And Tony just like couldn't get this out of his head. And so he went up to the owner of the diner. He said, do they come in here often? He said, oh yeah, every night after work. And so they had this idea that they would throw a birthday party for Agnes, this woman. And so the two of them spend the whole next day getting this party ready, like getting streamers and balloons, like filling this gross diner with all of these decorations, like telling all these people in the community that they should come. And then they get this big cake. And Agnes walks in at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is what Tony says. Never have I seen a person so flabbergasted, so stunned, so shaken. Her mouth fell open. Her legs seemed to buckle a bit. One of her friends grabbed her arm to steady her. As she was led to one of the stools, we all sang happy birthday. And as it came to an end, happy birthday, dear Agnes, happy birthday to you. Her eyes filled with tears. And then the birthday cake with all the candles was carried out and she lost it, openly weeping. The diner owner grumbled, blow out the candles, Agnes, come on, blow out the candles. I'm going to have to blow them out for you. This is actually in Hawaii. That was not his accent. That was just poetic license on my part. I get to hear it again. Then he handed her a knife and said, cut the cake, Agnes. Yo, Agnes, we all want some cake. And Agnes looked out at the cake. And then without taking her eyes off it, she said, look, Harry, if it's all right with you, I mean, if it's okay, if I just keep the cake for a little while. I mean, is it all right if I don't eat it right away? Harry shrugged. Sure, keep it if you want. It's your cake. Take it home if you want to. Can I? She looked at Tony and said, I live just a couple doors down. I just want to take the cake home. I'll be right back, I promise. And she took the cake home because she wanted to show her kids. And she carried it out of there like the Holy Grail. We all sat motionless as she left. You always have the poor with you, Jesus tells the disciples. And in this moment, we're invited to look into two different economies that give us two competing visions of the world. For Judas, the world is a place where the stealthy and the sly have a chance to make more. If you have the skills, you can get not just what you need, but more. I don't know, maybe Judas thought that he deserved it. Maybe he thinks he's worked harder than the other disciples, or that he's just figured out the system. So of course it makes sense to take advantage of it. If we're shocked by this act of stealing from the common purse, maybe we can remember that this is actually how our economy works. People take more than they need from the common abundance of our world. And then we praise people for being smart and savvy because they figured out how to do it. They write books about it to tell us how we can be more like them. We get television shows that put on display their mansions and their cars. But the disciples of Jesus, they've got one bank account. We don't get any sense of how they decided what to do with this money, but they put everything they have together. And no doubt this included almsgiving. Keep your hand open to the poor, we read in Deuteronomy. It's important to hear that Judas' complaint is not about the poor. It's about his economics, how he understands who gets and who takes, who deserves, who does not, which is to say the objections we hear to providing for the poorest among us are always about the economics of the old order, always. And so we might think, oh, well, we come over here to the economics of Jesus, we'll get the opposite. If one side is about hoarding wealth and extravagant displays of that wealth, on the other side, we'll get fear-laden asceticism and ruthless budgeting. But Jesus surprises us again, because it turns out that that's part of the logic of the old order too. The new economics of Jesus is actually trust. Our lives are marked by moments of interrupting recognition beyond any logic that will make sense in the old order. And we respond. We respond irrationally and at cost, knowing that God will provide for whatever lack we have for the giving away. We witness in the celebration of a found child and a lost coin, of perfume that Mary buys to wipe the feet of Christ who enters her home. This week, I've been reading a book by Susan Dunlap called The Religious Lives of Unhoused People. She did this ethnographic study where she spent a lot of time with people who are unhoused to figure out what it is they did to sustain themselves for survival. And she said that there's just a common lectionary of phrases that help to keep this community alive. Phrases like, God is in control, and the devil can't steal my joy, and no weapon formed against me shall prosper. And I hear Susan echoing back to me that it's easy for me to be cynical about those things, because I went to seminary and I know it's not so simple. Maybe this isn't great theology. Doesn't this just justify the lives that these people are in, their harm? And then I stop and I wonder, how does this reflect back on me? What does it reveal about me? My body in these clothes, in that house, in my retirement plan? Maybe in the midst of all of that, there's something for me to hear about trust from people who have almost nothing. I don't like this, but Jesus is asking us to believe this absurd thing today, that we can trust God and we can trust one another. God asks us to believe that we can respond in ways that are foolish to the economics of our day, that we can be faithful in our response of love, because God can be trusted. I know we're all coming out of a really painful season, an incredibly difficult season of not enough toilet paper and not enough vaccines, not enough time, where scarcity was everywhere in our lives. It was hard to trust. It's still hard to trust. And so I want to invite you to take this little piece of paper that my delightful helpers passed out. I invite you to write a place where it's been difficult for you to trust, where you have had a difficult time believing in the abundance of God in this season. And as we hear the next song, I invite you to come forward and place these in the bowl as we pour out to God places where we are longing to be upended and to make room for trust again.